Welcome to Season 4, Episode 13 of the Practical 365 Podcast with me, Steve Goodman, and Paul Robichaud. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, Steve. I'm battling Teams audio problems, just like we all are. How are you?
Thankfully, not battling Teams audio problems, but it's been a struggle this week with the new Teams app enforcing itself on me, which, given that I'm the administrator of my own tenant, feels kind of frustrating. But that aside, pretty good.
Good. I've been using the new Teams client on macOS since it was in preview. And for the most part, I'm very happy with it. I think the problems that I tend to have are more oriented around the service and not the client. But I don't do nearly the breadth of different things that you do, right? I don't run apps. I'm not doing recording for streaming, et cetera. So for daily use, I've been very happy with it, especially the new tenant switching and multi-tenant support features. Those work quite well.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn because I like the idea of it being faster. I'm yet to find it faster, realistically speaking. Perhaps it's all these new features coming along. I don't know. I can't. Or perhaps I just don't give it enough of a chance. I keep on probably slowing it down by uninstalling it and then going back. Yes, the new Teams is definitely big, big push from Microsoft. There's a few updates bringing features into it. And actually, it's got some new features that have been arriving. For example, like the way that we broadcast this or record it with NDI, it now finally has that. So we started this call with me moaning that it didn't have it because it didn't last show. And had automatically switched me to it. And then I checked and it had arrived. So Microsoft are quickly adding all of these features to get parity, swifter than they did on the old Skype to Teams sort of switch as well. So I moan, but then when I go and check, I find, you know, a lot of good new features. And we're starting to see new features arrive inside that new Teams client as well, aren't we? That are first to there or don't get backport sealed.
Yeah. Microsoft made a big deal out of that in their blog post this month saying, oh, we have 33 new features and enhancements in the January update, which I thought okay, great flex to be able to say that you have 33, because that sounds like a lot. But I think you and I are mostly in agreement that maybe not all of those 33 are world beating, you know, earth shattering improvements.
Well, yes. We'll come back to them in just a moment. On the show today, we have Andy Honeycutt joining us for the show. Andy Honeycutt is an expert in business change and adoption, works in healthcare in the US. So enjoy him a little bit later on. But first, a word from our sponsors. The Experts Conference Tech European Roadshow is back and coming to London, Paris and Munich, March 18th, 19th and 21st. The event's going to be jam-packed with Active Directory and Microsoft 365 training from the experts themselves. Plus, if you register by February 15th, you can get 10% off using the code PRACTICAL365 at the checkout. We hope to see you there.
My tech experiences, my feelings are a little hurt that Jennifer didn't invite me to the European version this year. So I'll have to talk to her about that separately.
Starting the show with these big, non-world changing, as you said, news
33.
Items.
33.
Yes. I think this is the thing, you know, Teams has very fast done what Microsoft are very good at doing, which is become the leading thing in the thing that they're doing, which is Teams is ubiquitous now. You still get people who occasionally call Teams Zoom or companies that use Zoom and think everybody else does, but they seem few and far between in the UK at least. So everybody uses Teams. So, okay, that probably means that it's got most of the features most organizations need to go about their day-to-day jobs, right? So any improvements that cause any problems or any improvements that maybe we look through and go, we don't need that. We'd rather have this feature we've been waiting for years can seem a bit underwhelming. But also it could be that they're underwhelming because Microsoft aren't having to compete as hard. And they're focused on the shiny things over there instead.
I mean, there's some truth to that. I think also in fairness, it has to be said, some of the improvements are limited in, well, I was going to say limited in scope, limited in audience or limited in appeal. So for example, man, it's great. I love that Microsoft has got new partner integrations for call center integrations.
Yes.
But that's not the world I live in. I don't have anything to do with call centers other than sometimes I, you know, call someone who works in one. So that might be a huge change to people who are in the call center industry, but I'm not. So I look at that and I go, yeah, okay, no big deal. There's another category of changes for things like the new controls for audio video, right? And selecting which device you're going to use and so forth. I think the new interface for doing those things, I mean, the change is an improvement, but man, I've got to say that it surprised and puzzled me a little bit. And I feel like that's true of many of the other end users that I work with, because they didn't know that change was coming. And when it did come, it wasn't immediately obvious, you know, what was new or what was different.
During this very cool, things that have changed and moved around to improve it repeatedly confuse me, because you've got muscle memory, haven't you, for where things are, and then they move ever so slightly, and then it just becomes difficult. I'm always used to looking for device settings as well, rather than audio settings in the new Teams client. So things that move around like that, it's frustrating for end users. And it's not, it's one of those things that I think if you're in IT, you're not going to get people phoning the help desk, but people will just find it a small niggle where something's changed and you don't know why. You know, like if a bit like with Windows 11, you get updates, they change a few things around, things move across, an icon changes from one thing to another. You try and hide your Bing/Copilot button and then it comes back with a sidebar. You move all those little things that are just really annoying niggles. And they're also what we've signed up for, an evergreen service where if they weren't improving
it does sort of seem like at some point, you know, for some of these changes in the new Teams client, if you knew you wanted to change the AV controls, it seems like you could have done that before you released the client, instead of releasing the client and making everyone relearn new muscle memory and, you know, new behaviors, and then making another change on top of that. And I realize this, that's a little bit of a,
it's a
simplistic viewpoint that doesn't take into account the fact that these feature teams are all running at different cadences, right? I mean,
this is not a problem that a user should have or a customer should have either. You know, you go into McDonald's, they don't go, well, we've changed the size of the patties, so now they hang out the side of the bun. But that's not our fault. That's the fault of the burger patty team, because they weren't talking to the burger bun team. And I know that's a really stupid example, but Microsoft are famed for not talking to each other when they develop different products. This is just one. And it's a bit like you're redecorating the room. And whilst somebody's painting the wall, somebody else is now trying to put up pictures. And you're like, no, wait. If it was my partner and I started another job in the same room I was redecorating before I'd finished, then she would have something to say about it. And it is Microsoft's, the Teams product group, Jeff Depper, it's somebody's job in those teams to say, look, before you start making UX changes to the Teams new client, get it finished and everybody over. And then plan out a tranche of changes. That would seem to make logical sense.
It would. I understand the argument that you want every team to go as fast as they can on the specific thing that they work on. That's much more a mindset that you have to have when you are in a contested or a very competitive space.
Yeah.
And to your point earlier, you know, does Microsoft have to compete as much against Zoom and whoever else is in that space? I don't know. Right. I mean, clearly they clearly do not want to just shift into neutral and coast. And that's good. But
I suspect if you install Zoom, it will still look like an old Win32 app.
Probably. we know that's true of WebEx, right?
Yeah. And people, this is the thing, people like simple things. It's everything's there where you know it. And this is, we're technologists. We like progress at the same time. So I feel silly complaining about it in a way, because you know.
There's meaningful progress, and there's progress for progress's sake, if you can call it that. And again, that's not entirely fair, right? I always try to be mindful of the fact that there are human beings just like me and you who put a lot of time and effort into these changes. And I don't,
Every
crap on that.
Every time I'm thinking, why has this change been made? The flip side is, but this is what I want. This is the thing I've signed up for. We wouldn't have anything to talk about on the podcast if they didn't keep on making changes. But
okay, fair point.
Yeah, it's completely good that they're delivering on all these things that they promised to do so over the years. And there is also the resistance of being a bit grumpy about it. Oh, I don't know where, my muscle memory has to change. There's upsides and downsides. In a way, our conversation is reflecting what we hear from people and what we see. And what, if we were to look at the non-technical people we know, work with and so on, that use the product and they have those little gripes about stuff. And it's usually our job, like it is if you're listening and you're supporting anybody, to then go, that's okay, it's changed for these reasons. It's a good thing because of this. And then try and make sure that they understand why it's changed. They understand that the move, and this is why women are looking through some of this stuff. And you go, well, why is this moved? Why has it changed names? We do know behind the back end that Microsoft will have done A/B testing with users. They will have done user research against renaming stuff that will make it easier for people who are new to the product. If you're an elderly, non-technical grandfather or somebody like that picked it up for the first time, would they find the setting more easily because of this change? And many of those things, like the audio settings, of course they would, right?
I mean, they would eventually. But you're right that, the minor cognitive load of having to think, oh, wait a minute, where did they put this thing? Okay, they moved it from here to over here. Okay, that's not a big deal. Sometimes Microsoft makes bigger changes. So the fact that they've started rolling out conditional access policies in Entra ID.
Yes.
Kind of a big deal. And one, when I write the practical protection column for practical365.com, it seems like sometimes all I do is write about conditional access stuff.
Yeah.
And that's because that team is continually delivering goodness in useful increments. And, to draw a contrast, there are things that the team's team has done where I said, okay, I can see why somebody might want that, but I don't know why.
Yeah.
Or I don't know why they did that at all. Right? Why did they spend even 5 minutes on that feature? I never have that feeling with the CA policy team. Everything that they release, I can say, okay, great. I see why they did that. It makes sense. It fits into their strategy. I understand what it's for. And this is no different. So you can trace an arc where first there was no MFA, and then Microsoft introduced MFA, but nobody used it. And then they started enforcing it first for GA or global admin accounts and then for more accounts. And so you see this, this steady trend of adoption. I think conditional access policy is following a very similar rollout. First, there was none. Then there was a thing that very few people used. And then as the combination of people recognized that it was useful, but also Microsoft started flipping switches to enforce it in certain cases.
Yeah.
It became more widely adopted. And I think these changes play right into that path.
And we're at a stage where people understand that. A lot of people do understand that the biggest threat is a cyber threat. In terms of warfare against different countries, these days. And also, if anybody uses online banking or services like that, then almost all of these use some form of two-factor authentication. The kids, when they're using Roblox and games like that, have to use this. And it has always been such a gap where you kind of have needed, apart from some basic policy templates, a skilled person to help build out policies and also defaults, where if you tick a whole bunch of boxes, you could end up locking yourself out of your tenant. you'll get warnings to say so. You know, it shouldn't be that complicated. So I
saw somebody on Twitter said that they had a customer a client of theirs that had done exactly that. They made a change to a CA policy and locked out 20,000 users.
Exactly. So and
you're right.
Cautionary tales. And some people will scoff at that and go, I do this all the time. I never test them. I just do them. I know what I'm doing. And that's great until the day that you don't. And until you mess things up, then you probably, everybody does at some point. It's only human to do so.
Oh, sure.
And that's a horrible mistake to make. Right. And there is a flip side to this, which is these great features need to be easy for businesses to use. They shouldn't require consultants to come in and plan the basics. Consultants to your business who are helping out, Microsoft partners and so on, they should be focusing on much more interesting things that can help you do things. They should be bringing in your SSO apps en masse, so they all use Entra ID, not sorting out basic conditional access policies, all sorts of stuff like that, that's better and more valuable to the business than making sure you're the same as the worst or better in terms of MFA. Bringing you up to a base level of security is kind of what you're paying for from Microsoft. So I am absolutely in agreement that this, having these policies over time, if we go ahead a few years, it should be almost something that is never really configured by even the largest enterprises. It's something that comes as part of the service.
Right. It should be automatic as much as possible.
Yeah.
But not more. And so, this is a fight we always have with people or two factions. There's a faction that says, look, the system, the substrate, whatever you want to call it, has more than enough data, more than enough signal to decide what the correct policy should be.
Yeah.
And Microsoft already does this in many ways. For example, there are certain things that signal a risky sign-in that Entra ID is going to block. And you don't get the option to say, nope, you know what? YOLO, I'm going to ride my motorcycle without a helmet, and I'm going to allow those obviously risky sign-ins anyway. There is an argument to be made that when you know what you are doing, you need an escape hatch or a way to tweak those policies, because there might be a really good reason why you want to allow sign-in from North Korea, during this one particular window when, I don't know, you're doing something.
Yeah.
But I like where Microsoft is going, right? The language they use around what they're doing with CA policies is focused on, hey, we have a lot of signal. We want to use machine learning against that signal to figure out how to set the policies up, and we will evolve or change them over time as the signal changes. In other words, when there's a new threat or when we see a new pattern of behavior, then we'll evolve the policies.
Yeah.
The other thing that I like even more than that is they're going to put these policies in place, and then you have a 90-day window to customize them or review them before they get turned on in your tenant. And I love that, because that means – you can have the policy in report mode. You can see what it would have done. And if there's something you need to change, you can change it. That's much preferable to
here's a new policy.
Hope you like
it. It is effectively following a set of best practices that you would follow, but you're not having to necessarily read all the documentation and figure out the best way out of five different ways of doing something.
Yes.
Everybody likes best practices, right? And this is all always going to be getting more complicated with all the different services that you can buy from Microsoft or have added to your tenant. So yeah, this is making sure it follows those best practices is absolutely, a good thing. And I agree, there needs to be not an escape hatch, but also there is always going to be unusual use cases or particular scenarios. But right. By getting rid of legacy authentication and some of these things that have been the key to needing to have your own set of custom policies or having to do things in an old way when you'd have preferred to do them a new way, this is, as these legacy endpoints get decommissioned, as those services get switched off across tenants, your tenant example, for example, then this is this is what Microsoft can now do, and perhaps couldn't before without all that knowledge and signals and built-in understanding now of who connects for right. what services, what are the legacy apps out there, great understanding of their enterprise customers to their smaller customers. You know, we've heard this from the horse's mouth, so to speak, from these teams who are dealing with this, that they care about it a lot and they're doing a lot about it. And we heard from Alex a while back what a big problem threats are to your identity and why you probably don't want this to be completely your problem.
No, there's a lot that Microsoft is doing that people don't see or realize, right? I mean, there's, I don't know how many thousands or tens of thousands of servers there are processing these sign-in requests and doing stuff with them against the threat model and training that threat model and so on. The Microsoft, you know, they don't talk about those things. They talk about how many paid users they have, which is something we're going to get to in just a second. Mm-hmm. But they don't ever tell you, yeah, we have, you know, 50,000 servers that are doing nothing but processing intra-ID, you know, sign-in risk data. So there's a lot that happens under the waterline where the bulk of the iceberg is that we never see. We just get the benefits of it.
It was quite good news for Microsoft, at least. Things have been going up and up. So over the last month, we've heard that Microsoft are now one of the largest in value companies, or the largest from time to time now, surpassing Apple and, well, everybody else. And they're also highlighting a rapid adoption of Copilot for Microsoft 365, which, since it's went on to CSP, I suspect they have more active users than they have in their EAP or early enterprise customers who had been adopting it.
Yeah, I suspect they do. You know, one of the things I like about Tony's write-ups of these quarterly results is that he always sort of shines a light on what's missing, like the old criminologist used to do. So Microsoft always wants to emphasize the numbers that make them look good, which, you know, everybody does.
Yeah.
So 400 million paid users is that's a huge milestone, right? There's no getting around that. 9% year-over-year growth in their commercial seats. Again, that's fantastic. They claimed a 99.996 SLA performance, which very good. Doesn't diminish the fact that sometimes, you know, if the shadow happens to fall on you and your tenant, then, you know, you may have 0% or not zero. You may have much lower uptime, but with 400 million users, you know, there has to be a large effect before it moves that number. But then when they say, oh, you know, rapid adoption of Copilot, we have 10,000 organizations using Copilot Studio. Okay, that's great. But what does that mean in practical terms? It's not
Copilot Studio. This is the thing. What is Copilot Studio? It is a product that's been renamed.
Right.
You know, so.
But 10,000 users.
Well, 10,000 organizations. But that means anybody that's opened it. Every, you know, if anybody's used it in your organization, you've seen these drop in and wondered what they are. But those licenses were already there, weren't they, for the Power Virtual Agents, right?
Well, that's what I mean by highlighting the numbers that make you look good, right? Microsoft, I think, is not ready to say anything about how many users are using the Copilot products that are now more widely available. But if what you have 10,000 organizations using Copilot Studio, it has Copilot in the name. Hey, let's talk about that for sure. You know, that's natural.
I suppose the proof is in the pudding more than anything else. So let's speak to our guest who's joining us to talk about Copilot adoption and much, much more, Andy Hunnicutt.
Welcome, Andy.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me. Really looking forward to this one.
So, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself first? Because I know that you are working on a lot of Copilot, but many other things as well for large healthcare organization in the US. But for those of you that don't know who Andy is, Andy, tell us a little bit about your background.
So I'm an enterprise collaboration specialist. I focus on Microsoft 365, Power Platform, and kind of all things in the Microsoft ecosystem. I've been an independent contractor, trainer, consultant going back for like 15 years. I currently I'm in a role with a large healthcare organization with their user adoption, deployment, and training scenarios, also providing some help with like strategy and alignment and deployment of new technologies like Microsoft Copilot. Outside of that, I've been involved in the SharePoint community. That's where I came from for the better part of 10 or 12 years. I lead the Charlotte area SharePoint user group here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And every now and then I get invited out on the conference circuit and get to participate in those events. I've been a tech speaker in the past and contributed a little bit over there and some of the other conferences as well. But I'm kind of in the community and out there. You can also find me on social media. I'm pretty active in YouTube. And lastly, I am the co-host of 365 Deep Dive along with John Moore, where once a month we take a couple hours and just go through every bell and whistle we can for products and take live Q&A and, you know, just really explore Microsoft technology.
Yes, I love John. He's very good. But there's a few key things that I was interested in that you're working on. One is multi-tenant organizations, which is almost like a whole topic in itself. And Microsoft 365, or Copilot for Microsoft 365, as it's now known. And I imagine that there's some interesting parts as to multi-tenant organizations and Copilot, which is a third topic altogether. But I wanted to have a chat about Copilot, knowing that you're working actively in the midst of quite a big rollout of it. Mm-hmm. So do you want to tell us a bit about when you started, or when the organization you're working with started its Copilot journey?
Yeah, so we were participants in the early access program. I came on board the project around like August of last year. When the time I came on board, it was actually in one of our other tenants. We're multi-tenant, as you mentioned earlier. And one of our other tenants had started the EAP program, and they had started rolling it out to about 85 users or so. And then I came on board in that program when they needed to kind of realign a little bit. Initially, we rolled it out to a lot of information workers, but mainly in IT, and we weren't really getting the perspective of the different business units. So kind of coming on board, we expanded the program a little bit, realigned it more with business units across that particular section of the organization. And then in December, we decided to extend the pilot program into one of our other tenants. Now, in that case, we're running two separate buckets of 300 users. At the time, 300 was the minimum number of seats that you could get. So we had two separate buckets of 300 coming out. And then we're looking at extending it into some of our other tenants in the future. So we're definitely expanding that. But as we're doing that, it's kind of taking almost a phase-like approach to deployment. We learned a lot from the initial 85 that we rolled it out from. And then from there, we've taken those lessons learned and used that to kind of accelerate the deployment, the onboarding, the training, and the user adoption story. But it also has helped us a lot from the IT management side on the back end. A lot of lessons learned the hard way when we first started rolling out from like a data management and security, but also a technology standpoint, updating Office apps and licensing and so forth. But that's kind of where we stand today. We've got a few different deployments of it. We're trying to align the phases so that everybody's kind of on the same page, and then building communities around that and growing our adoption story.
Yeah, so one thing that I've heard from other customers who have been on EAP or bought some licenses is that one, there's blockers that they're very concerned about, and some of these can be unfounded, but some are very well founded, and sometimes they're worried about things that actually they shouldn't be, and they should probably be worried about something actually, you know, altogether different. Now, in healthcare, you've got very strict compliance and regulations to adhere to, both over here in the UK, Europe, and obviously in the USA. So how did, and this is a question that probably most people buying some licenses, and they've got to get it past the risk and compliance person, asking, how did you get it past that? And what's your experiences been in terms of what were things as bad as you expected? How does Copilot react to the sort of questions that people have feared it might answer?
Mm-hmm. So that's probably the biggest initial hurdle is the data privacy and security, working with the corporate compliance office and the security office. We worked very closely with Microsoft. We got a BA agreement worked out on that. And then we do have Microsoft compliance licensing in place, and we have DLP, and we have a lot of that structure in place because we're a healthcare organization. We've had that for a while, and so it was a little easier for us to kind of implement Copilot into that. That being said, there were still some things that we had to work out through, like policy in the beginning, such as the use of transcripts within meetings, clearly defining corporate policy around the use case of Copilot around sensitive information, private information. So we had to have guidelines and definitive policies built around that. Start with a small test case so you can kind of understand the ins and outs of that. Share that story with those teams. Engage your corporate compliance and your security teams early on in the process. Include them. It's a conversation, kind of like you have with Copilot, and work through some of those mechanisms to control how Copilot's going to interact with the content within the organization. A big topic I'm seeing right now is data cleanup. Microsoft's been pushing that hard and heavy since they announced Copilot last year. With your information in the Microsoft cloud, cleaning it up, trying to prevent oversharing. But that also extends into permissioning on top of that information, how you structure that information, how you apply your purview, compliance, features, retention, labeling. Metadata is also a big part of that. And so you're going to find pretty quickly where some scenarios exist where there might be some oversharing and some cleanup that needs to be done. And it has to happen at multiple levels. So getting those teams involved early was really key for us. Now we're kind of working through to the end user and the participants in the program. And then they're doing some spring cleaning and some self cleanup, but we're also using a lot of tools and reporting to kind of help guide a lot of that.
Yeah. One thing that I work in an organization with a large team of SharePoint experts, especially coming from an information architecture side. And this is certainly one point that they've been stressing around that, but sometimes that can fall on deaf ears. Mm-hmm. So you've managed to make some progress there. But in terms of what people are, often there's a carrot, isn't there? And if people see the benefits of something, they might adopt it. For example, if an organization had adopted classifications in purview but left them to users to apply, the users might not apply them without any sort of a good reason. Have you found Copilot has been received well and is therefore helping drive some of those behaviors around data?
So you're going to, when you roll it out, there's going to be a few things that are going to be really evident. Initial excitement. There's this new tool. People have been talking about generative AI and ChatGPT, and now we're talking about Copilot.
Isn't it? I think we've even got, what seems like we've wheeled out the old graphs of the trough of disappointment to sort of elaborate a little bit on that. But
I've heard
customers say people are excited, but they don't really know what they're going to use it for.
You have to connect to purpose. Yeah. So we have this amazing thing. What can I do with it? So Microsoft has the Art of the Possible, a 2-hour workshop where you kind of work through that. And that's good for a subset of people that are going to participate in it. But you have to have people that understand the business processes to engage with the Copilot program.
Yeah.
You take that initial excitement, apply to those business processes, then you can start identifying use case. Then you can start identifying champions, people that are enthusiastic about the application and that can evangelize it, help drive it to other parts of the organization. You can find within your use cases roles and processes that you can scale to other parts of the business, and you can get a ton of business value. Then you can start identifying things like, okay, here's how we're going to support it. Here's how we're going to provide training around it. And kind of going down that rabbit hole just a little bit with, there's some things you can do to successfully integrate it into your workflows. Things like identifying those key use cases. And it can be within a business unit, but also look across the organization. Could this use case apply to another business unit? Could they benefit from some of this? Then you start your onboarding program. So you're going to have the people that go through it initially. You're going to try to get them up to speed with what it can do, and then connecting to that purpose, how you can do it through the onboarding. Then you'll go down to things like some customized and tailored training sessions. Maybe you spend some time on a specific Copilot experience or a Copilot experience, a couple of Copilot experiences within a business process and how that works. But you have to provide regular feedback loops inside of that. You can't just, here's Copilot, you know, yeah, go and learn how to prompt and do all this stuff. You have to show how to use it within the flow of work, but get feedback from users. What are they struggling with? Why is it not giving them the results that they're looking for? What's been successful? How can we champion that to other people? Then you start learning how to measure some of that.
And have you been using any of the tools from Microsoft or dashboards from Viva Insights to help with that? Or what was the older Power BI reporting? Have those been useful?
Yes. So we're using a couple of different things. So there is the Copilot dashboard in the admin center, and it's expanded recently. Now you can get some more granular information. Right now, kind of what you see in there is, all right, this Copilot experience, Copilot in Word, has been used by this number of people with Copilot licenses. So if you've got 300, 280 have touched it in the last 7 days or the last 30 days. But it doesn't tell you how much time they spent with it. It doesn't tell you whether, you know, they were just like using a default prompt or, you know, the summarize button. Now the reporting is showing a little bit more detail. This person engaged with these specific Copilots, and then they used the summarize feature. So then you can get a little bit more granular view of what's happening with that. But we've kind of augmented that with some additional custom reporting that we have based off of usage of apps and so forth. That just kind of helps us with our licensing and keeping those licensing costs in play. And the next step really for us is figuring out how to roll out some use cases for users to test and provide feedback, and then roll out some information on how to measure the impact of Copilot in a business process. Process without it, and then process with Copilot, and then kind of look at the delta there and see, like, are we saving time with this? And then we've had some conversations with Microsoft around identifying use cases within a specific business and whether we can scale that to other parts of it. So there's some out-of-the-box tooling that's getting better, and Microsoft's making improvement, but we're also working on some of our own.
Yeah, I think that point that you make, Aaron, was one thing, measuring that it is or isn't being used, so you can help find areas to perhaps target assistance. But the big question is trying to identify, one, tangible savings in particular areas, but then what can be quite intangible savings or improvements, where somebody might be better at doing something, but it might take them the same amount of time, or they might be more successful about it, but it's quite hard to measure. You know, for example, if it was a salesperson, whilst the economy changes, then they might actually be able to maintain a level that they wouldn't have otherwise, and it wouldn't measure particularly well on pure statistics alone. But they'd know that without this tool, they'd not be as effective. So it's difficult. I mean, you've got user resistance as well. You know, if you recount how much of that?
Not so much.
Particularly around people who it seems like it's perfect for, but they go, well, I know that this will improve my job, but I don't like the idea of it. You know, that sort of user resistance, where it's almost an intelligent, well thought out, then it, almost they're inferring that they could, that there might be turkeys waiting for Christmas, or they just don't like the look of it.
So some of the resistance that we've seen is, and I'm going to go back to a point you were just talking about a second ago, Excel. It does some really powerful things. The analytics and the insights that it can provide in your table-based data is not a, might not be immediately apparent to you as an end user. Adding in new columns and calculations that you may not have seen are really, really powerful. But you get a really experienced Excel user, and they start looking at this workbook, and then they look at Copilot, and they might be a little let down. They're like, you know, I can create a chart way faster than waiting on Copilot to do this for like the next 30 seconds.
You know what? I've seen the same where I work. I've our finance team. I was chatting to them, and it's kind of a mistake. I mentioned this on the podcast before, but there was an ESPN for Excel. I mentioned this to them at one of these things where you go for a drink. And they then talked for ages about who'd win it if they were to compete. And before Copilot, they were quite eager to be able to use this tool. And again, you know, I think they've had a similar experience to the one you've seen there, where they're expert users in a tool that is already automating a lot of things that they do. It's like Copilot is a calculator for other things in a way, and Excel is already that. So it's, but I find it massively useful because I don't know how to do a pivot table.
It's great with formulas, figuring out like formulas and debugging. It's really good, not the Copilot necessarily in Excel, but Copilot chat is really good at helping you to create sample data so that you can test and work through formulas and sample data without having to like use your real data. That's super helpful. I've done a number of scenarios around that. So when you start showing some scenarios like that, that's when the light bulbs start to go off. But it's when you encounter a power user that you start to get a little bit of resistance, because they're like, well, I can do this a little bit faster. The thing I want people to keep in mind is that right now, Copilot is very much in its infancy. Like I say all the time, it's like an intern that just onboarded in the organization. It's going to take a little while to get up to speed. And at some point, it's going to surpass your capabilities, but it's not going to replace you. It's called Copilot, not Autopilot. It's there to sit next to you and extend your capabilities, because there still has to be a human involved in this. Yeah, it can manipulate data in an Excel table, but you are the one that has to verify the accuracy of the results of that, and does it fit with the desired goal that you're looking for? And but going back to the resistance, the other kind of resistance that we've seen a little bit is integration with other systems. So like, immediately, your people are like, I have all this information in this other system. I need Copilot to connect to it right now. And unless we do Copilot Studio, or you know, we do custom Copilot in, you know, in Azure, like we're not there yet. Give us time, you know, we'll get there. But let me show you what you can do with it today to get you on board with it and enthusiastic about it. And then we can roll out those capabilities as we learn more about it, and as that stuff's created by Microsoft, and as our team gets up to speed on it, then we'll be able to roll it into that external solution. So those are just a few of the things, like forms of resistance that we've seen. And then the last one I'll mention is change fatigue. The Microsoft 365 ecosystem is nonstop change. Change management is really hard. Changing the way that people work is really hard. We have to sell people on this can help you to do more with less effort. This can extend your capabilities. Maybe now you don't need to take meetings notes. You can just be present in the meeting. That's when the light bulb goes off and they're like, oh, I can just have it generate the notes. And then you kind of start steering them away from that resistance and change fatigue into what is actually possible with it. Then people are more enthusiastic to engage and really embrace it.
I think you've had some good points here. One, and one is around that journey that you're on with Microsoft. I think it's probably said before that it's like Teams 5 years ago. You were buying into a journey. You were buying into a vision for Microsoft. It's early days. of the product, as you say, and those light bulb moments as well. The one you described had exactly the same thing, you know, analysis of self-analysis, or almost like an independent view of what's happening in the meeting. You know, how well are we doing? Is this being received well? What are the key things? And also being able to just use it to be more present, rather than, as I used to do, take notes all the time to make sure I didn't forget anything. So I'm tapping away on the keyboard. And then you can sit back and actually just, once you learn to trust it to get certain things right, then it's, you know, those are really good use cases that come out of it. That is all we've got time for, though, today. But thank you so much for joining us. So for those that want to follow you online, do you want to let us know how to get your podcast, and if you're on Twitter, where to follow you at?
So Twitter at Andy Honeycutt. who knows what we're calling it today. Yes. You'll find me on LinkedIn as William Honeycutt. That's my first name, but I go by Andy, but I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. And then you'll find me on YouTube at 365 Deep Dive, but also Andy Honeycutt there as well.
Cheers. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much.
Now,
good stuff, man. Thank you.
That is all we have time for on the show today. I do hear that Rich has been lining up even more great guests for the next shows coming up, which is quite exciting. You might well have seen the emails pop up whilst we were recording, actually. I'm going to keep it under my hat as to who that is. But let's just say it's going to be exciting.
My lips are sealed. I can disclose it will not be Elon Musk. It will not be Christian Horner from the Red Bull Formula One team. Other than that, I'm not saying. But if you want to find out, make sure you subscribe to the Practical 365 podcast at either practical365.com or wherever you get your other good podcast from.
Thanks, and see you next time.